Hey, it's Mike McEntee. Welcome to the Great Minnesota Meltdown. Yes, all that stuff is starting to melt off the roads, and it's going to come back tomorrow. Don't get too happy about spring. Spring is something that eventually will happen, and we hope that we get at least a weekend of summer here sometime here in Minnesota. Coming up on the show here today, we are going to hear from Minnesota's newest Supreme Court Justice, as you heard Matt talking about. It is Paul Thiessen. Governor Dayton announced that today, but we'll hear from Paul Thiessen, the former Speaker of the House, on a lot of different topics, including what's prepped him for the job. Also, Governor Dayton has a warning for the legislature. I'm sure you might have an idea what that is, but we'll get into that. But first, is President Trump creating a war cabinet? The recent elevation of former CIA Director Mike Pompeo to Secretary of State and newly appointed National Security Advisor John Bolton puts more hawks in Trump's inner circle. Here to discuss the threat that possibly poses is Ken Goode, Senior Fellow for National Security at the Center for American Progress. Ken, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here.
Good to have you on. So why should we be worried about Pompeo? We've kind of talked about this on the program in the past, but when it comes to our Secretary of State, why wouldn't he be a good guy for the job?
I think fundamentally the biggest problem with the notion of Mike Pompeo as Secretary of State is that Trump has picked someone who prefers regime change to diplomacy to be America's top diplomat. And his outlook on the range of national security issues that are facing the United States right now has almost always veered towards an aggressive military response and dramatically downplayed or flat out rejected the notion of negotiation as a way to achieve our national security and foreign policy objectives. And putting him in the State Department would really tip the balance in the cabinet towards this much more hawkish outlook than we had before. And I think many others are very concerned that puts us on a path to war.
Regime change, that's kind of a phrase that can mean a lot of different things. Obviously, war, as you mentioned, but how has that gotten us into trouble in the past with dealing with other countries?
The most striking example, of course, in the relative recent past is the war in Iraq in 2003 to topple Saddam Hussein. And Mike Pompeo's record on that isn't particularly long, but Trump's new national security advisor, John Bolton, was one of the most ardent supporters of the Iraq war when he was in the Bush administration, and not only did he actively campaign for it at the time, he still thinks it was a good idea. And he had he's been accused very credibly of politicizing the intelligence that helped get us into that war while he was a senior official at the State Department. And of course, there are now concerns that the Trump administration is doing the same thing with Iran around the JCPOA, around the Iran nuclear agreement, and the decisions that the president has coming up here in the next month or so about whether to withdraw from that treaty. And there are concerns that as CIA Director Mike Pompeo has shaded the intelligence information to kind of match up with his predetermined conclusion that the Iran deal was bad for the United States, even though the entire intelligence community, our military, and the international community has repeatedly certified that Iran is complying with that deal. So you can draw a pretty straight line from the most recent past instance of regime change in the Bush administration with John Bolton and others, to what's going on right now around the Iran deal and with people like Mike Pompeo, and that President Trump is putting these folks in at a time when they've got to make a very critical decision about whether to stay in the Iran deal and what that could mean in the aftermath.
Let's talk about the Iran deal for a moment, because the foregone conclusion from a lot of, not a lot of conservatives, but from some folks, is that it's been a bad deal. That's what Trump's been saying all over and over again. What happens if the Iran deal is undone? Can it be undone? And just by pulling out, the U.S. pulling out of the deal, does that undo it?
Well, it certainly would create problems. Now, fortunately, the other signatories to the deal, the three European countries, Russia and China, have indicated that they want to continue with the arrangement even if the United States pulls out. But the key question is going to be what happens with sanctions on Iranian entities and what happens on secondary sanctions for other companies and countries that continue to do business with Iran. And that's where things could really start to unravel. If the United States puts an enormous amount of pressure on companies in our European allies, for example, countries that are still maintaining the agreement, but because we have pulled out, we will reassert sanctions on Iran and on companies that do business with Iran. And it's really unclear what happens should the United States take those aggressive steps. But what is clear is that the United States will be extremely isolated in that situation. And with our European allies still trying to maintain the deal, the world community will look at the United States as the bad actor in this particular scenario, and that will further weaken our position. And at that point, we just don't know what the Iranians will do. If they will say, well, that this we've abided by the terms of the deal, the United States still decides to withdraw and apply sanctions to us, maybe they take reciprocal steps to kick out the inspectors or do some kinds of things that raise concerns that they may be trying to restart whatever nascent nuclear program that they have remaining. And then the tensions just continue to ratchet up. And, of course, with advisors like Mike Pompeo and John Bolton, there isn't a lot of confidence that the Trump administration would be able to manage that situation, manage that crisis, without it leading to a military confrontation.
So how do we know that Trump is going to listen to Bolton and Pompeo when he didn't listen to the people who formerly had the jobs, like H.R. McMaster and Rex Tillerson?
Well, interestingly, you know, you can never predict what Trump is going to do, but he did say when he announced the firing of Rex Tillerson, the former Secretary of State, that one of the reasons why he was removing Tillerson was because that they disagreed over whether to stay in the Iran deal. Tillerson wanting the United States to stay in, Trump obviously wanting the United States to pull out. And he's replaced him with Mike Pompeo, who has this very long record of being very aggressive about our relationship with Iran, how he completely tried as a member of Congress to undermine the negotiations during the Obama administration. And even after 1 year after the deal went into effect, he said that our objective should be regime change, not sticking with this deal. So we have seen what Mike Pompeo's position is. We now know that Trump fired Rex Tillerson, at least in part because of their disagreement over the Iran deal. And those pieces of information are giving a lot of people concern about what's going to happen here in the coming weeks and months.
Now, we spent a lot of time here talking about Iran and the deal there, because that obviously is something that Pompeo and Bolton have been focusing on. But there's also North Korea, and that is looming out there. The Trump administration today saying that is speaking directly at, quote, extremely high levels in advance of a potential meeting with Kim Jong-un. Is there any hope here that diplomacy is going to reign there, or are the hawks going to have Trump's ear for this?
First off, I think we all have to be at least a little bit grateful and pleased that we're talking about high-level direct negotiations between the United States and North Korea, and not kind of absurd schoolyard taunts about the size of their nuclear arsenal. And so that is an unequivocally positive step. But those steps towards negotiations are not immune from their own risks. Because as we've seen here with this administration, it isn't as if they have a long track record of pulling off extremely difficult things. They can't seem to do the easy things particularly well, and high-level negotiations with the North Koreans over their nuclear program, which, by the way, already exists. They already have nuclear weapons. They already have a ballistic missile program. So we would be in trying to get the North Koreans to give up those programs. It's a far more difficult and challenging prospect than the negotiations with the Iranians during the Obama administrations, because the Iranians did not possess nuclear weapons. They did not have ballistic missiles capable of reaching the United States. So this is a much more high-stakes negotiation with North Korea than it was with Iran, and we just have no confidence that this administration can actually pull it off. And of course, they seem to be making decisions and taking steps that make it even harder. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff told Congress last year, which is something that's quite obvious, that if the United States were to withdraw from the Iran deal, it would make it much less likely that the North Koreans would want to engage to reach an agreement with the United States about its own nuclear program. It isn't as if the North Koreans have clean hands here. You know, we've engaged in these kinds of negotiations with them in the past. We've reached agreements with them in the past, and they've themselves have abrogated them. So it's not as if we should have full faith and confidence in the North Koreans. But it is a clear and obvious point that withdrawing from the Iran deal would make our negotiations with North Korea that much more difficult. And so it is very troubling that the Trump administration seems to be going down this track simultaneously of being about to withdraw from the Iran deal while they're trying to put together this very high-level negotiation, possibly even including a direct meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. And the worry there is that if that meeting fails, or if those talks fail with North Korea, it's really hard to go back to the negotiating table after you've had the sit-down between the leaders. And so given this administration's track record, given the people that they're assembling around the president, and given the actions that they seem to be considering over the coming months here, there is a really grave concern that the administration is painting itself into a corner on North Korea, where the only option they will have, or at least in their own minds, the only option they will have to try and eliminate the threat from the North Korean nuclear program is to take military action.
We're speaking with Ken Good. He's the Senior Fellow for National Security with the Center for American Progress. Ken, you were mentioning that what Donald Trump was doing on Twitter was schoolyard taunts, and I think a lot of people would agree with that. But is that what got us to these negotiations? Is the only way to deal with a dictator is to act like a bully? Is that the only way to get his attention? Some conservatives are saying that's how we got here, is because President Trump was acting like that.
It doesn't strike me as if that's particularly plausible. The North Koreans have not acted as if they are concerned about what the United States might do. It seems much more likely that the North Koreans have recognized that the only people that were frightened by the president's actions was South Korea and the South Koreans. South Koreans were the ones who were concerned that the United States might launch a unilateral strike, and the North Koreans used that to their advantage and have really played a very skillful diplomatic game to bring in the South Koreans on their efforts to get what they've wanted all along, which is this direct negotiation between them and the United States. And so it seems as if, at least in my view, that it wasn't the president's taunts and how they affected North Korea that have maybe got us to this point, but it's how they affected our allies in South Korea. The North Koreans are in a pretty strong position. They've tested their nuclear weapons recently. They've made a number of very rapid advances in their ballistic missile program over the course of the last year and a half. And the North Koreans are coming to this negotiation from a position of relative strength compared to where they were a few years ago. So it doesn't seem as if the North Koreans have been threatened to the table at all. And in fact, they may be coming to the table feeling like their hand is pretty strong.
Now, as I listen to the White House press conferences, Sarah Huckabee Sanders often uses the term maximum pressure, saying that the sanctions that the U.S. has been putting in and the rest of the world has played quite a big part, I should say, in bringing North Korea to the table. When you look at it, do you buy that?
I think sanctions have had some positive impact on this, but again, I think it's just a complete misreading of the situation to think that the United States has been able to marshal and rally a united front against the North Koreans. Both our allies in South Korea and Japan, and the Prime Minister of Japan is meeting with President Trump right now, are extremely concerned about the direction of U.S. policy in North Korea. Just last month, Kim Jong-un made his first ever trip outside of North Korea since he became that country's leader, when he made a secret visit to Beijing to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping. It seemed that affirmed the closeness and the relationship between China and North Korea. So while it is probably correct to say that the sanctions and the new sanctions that have been imposed have had some impact, it is not correct to say that the United States has been able to marshal and rally a united international community and isolate North Korea. It seems as if perhaps the opposite is true.
Let's bring this back to where we started, because we started talking about here about Pompeo and Bolton being part of the cabinet and both of them being kind of hawkish. Given everything that we've talked about here, are you more concerned right now about us going to war than maybe we were a month or two ago?
Yes, most certainly. And, you know, we live here in Washington, D.C., and I work just a few blocks from the White House and live just a few blocks from the Capitol. And, of course, it is a concern that we have about what could possibly happen. Now, we should always say that the United States typically finds a way to muddle through in situations like this, and cooler heads very often prevail. Secretary Mattis in the Defense Department and the uniformed military have been among the most significant voices of restraint within the Trump administration, and I think we saw that with the manner in which the strikes against the Syrians here this past week were not perhaps as aggressive as President Trump signaled and promised they would be, and that may be an indication that cooler heads are prevailing on the inside, and hopefully that will happen as we come up against these two very critical crises in Iran and North Korea here in the coming months.
All right. We've been speaking with Ken Good. He's the Senior Fellow for National Security with the Center for American Progress. You can find more about what he writes over at AmericanProgress.org. Ken, thank you so much for helping us work through this today.
Great. Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here.
All right. We're going to take a break, but when we get back, we're going to talk about our new Minnesota Supreme Court Justice. We'll hear from him, as well as a warning from Governor Dayton to the Republicans in the legislature. That's all next year on the Mike McEntee Show.
What kind of a jackass would let an animal pick their insurance? Did you really think a lizard could save you money on car insurance? Would you let a duck pick your health policy? Insurance can be a zoo, but this is ridiculous. What you really need is an insurance agent that isn't looking out for the insurance companies. You need Cheryl at Array, an independent agent with 30 years experience looking for the best rate possible. Quit monkeying around and call 763-504-3067. That's 763-504-3067 for Cheryl at Array, representing you, not the insurance companies.
Guess who called me the other day? You did. Hi, Mark Sommerfeld of Computer Revolution in Roseville. I want to thank AM950 listeners who called to thank us for supporting the station. So here's an offer exclusive to 950 listeners. Bring your broken computer or cell phone to our Roseville store, say I'm an AM950 listener, and you'll receive $20 off any repair. Computer Revolution with cell phone repair, located in Roseville at Highway 36 and Fairview Avenue, or call 651-633-6600. And thanks.
6 years ago, Dr. Emily Stein was confronted with a life-changing situation. Her grandmother developed rheumatoid arthritis and was unable to maintain her own dental hygiene. Unfortunately, her assisted living facility didn't have the resources to help her maintain her dental health either. Once her dental health deteriorated, her overall health deteriorated too. It wasn't long until she had multiple tooth extractions and a severe stroke. That's when Emily put her Stanford background in microbiology and immunology to work. She created an oral care lozenge, or Smart Mint, that manages oral bacteria to promote strong teeth, healthy gums, and fresh breath. Daily Dental Care is a life sciences company dedicated to addressing public health by targeting the root cause of dental disease. Because let's face it, we all could use a little extra help supplementing our daily dental care routine. Visit dailydentalcareswithans.com or go to Amazon to purchase our lozenges and use promo code DDC95002 for a 25% discount on your first purchase.
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Daily Dental Care lozenges are not intended to replace daily dental hygiene practices.
Hey, welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. We have a new Minnesota Supreme Court Justice. David Strauss has been appointed to another court. He was one of the remaining Republican Pawlenty appointees in the court. And Governor Dayton today got to make his sixth pick for the court. Five of his picks now are on the court. And it's former House Speaker Paul Thiessen. Dayton today said he had a lot of, it was a hard decision because he had a lot of folks that were very, very qualified that got, nominated to him. There's a committee that goes ahead and does all this. Paul Thiessen, though, was the guy he picked. Paul Thiessen was running for governor, and that didn't work out. And so it would look like Paul Thiessen was going to be off of the political stage here because he was not going to run for his House seat again. And then this happened. So, Paul Thiessen today said he was really excited about it.
I am really excited and inspired by this opportunity to serve as an Associate Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court, above all because it really is an amazing opportunity to serve the state that I love so much and care so deeply about.
Now, as I mentioned, Thiessen had been campaigning around the state for governor, and he thought that that, along with working in the legislature for so many years, really had prepared him for the job.
But perhaps most importantly, the time that I've spent interacting with thousands of Minnesotans all across the state have led me to, and I hope, I think, prepared me well to take on this new endeavor. And serving on the court, I believe, is going to allow me to continue to advance the basic values that have long motivated the work that I've tried to do to promote fairness, to advance individual dignity and rights, to make sure that we're accountable to each other and that the institutions that are supposed to serve us are accountable to us, and perhaps most importantly, to make sure that every single person's voice is heard.
Now, Thiessen is going to officially resign on Friday. He's not going to take any more votes between now and then, but that's just long enough that Governor Mark Dayton doesn't have to call a special election for his seat. It takes X number of days to get all the stuff done, and this is like X number of days plus four. So Thiessen was already not running for re-election since he was running for governor, so a new representative from his district will be elected this November. Now, at the same news conference, Governor Dayton reminded Republicans that as they head into the last couple of weeks of the legislature, they should not do what they did last year, which was slip stuff into bills that he disagrees with, or they're going to get the same result as last year.
I've told them, and I put it in writing before, and I said it last year, and it was largely ignored, that they're trying to seed measures that are important that I do support into measures that I don't, either policy and or budget, is I'll veto, and then we'll be right back to the square one. But it's just whether it's the tax bill or whether it's any of the spending bills or the bonding bill or any just policy bills, I stand firm on that. If they want to try me out, they'll be able to do so. I just hope they will do so before the end of the session so we have time to remediate if that's possible.
And that time is a problem here because Dayton says the Republicans do need to get the bills to him, the big bills. Right now he's only gotten three bills. Major tax bills are not even through committee, and there's only a few weeks left in the session.
Well, as we talked again about the end of the session and the importance, in my view, of their getting these bills in public light, and then hold hearings, the tax bill in particular, and getting their process underway so it could be completed. So we have a timely. I told them I'm not going to call a special session. I'm not going to call a special session. I am not going to call a special session, not the day after and not the month after and not until after I leave office.
So are you going to call a special session?
It was snowing in July, although I hesitate to say that because I've seen snow up in the Iron Range on the 3rd of July, the night of the parades up there. So I'm in a, anyway.
You got that? No special session, unless it's snowing in July. And asked if he thinks that the GOP is stalling, hoping that they can get a Republican governor next year, Dayton says, I can't blame them. Former Governor Tim Pawlenty, speaking about Republican governors, you know he's running for governor again. He's raised more than $1 million since forming a campaign committee in March. That's according to state campaign finance reports released today. Pawlenty, he hasn't decided yet whether he is going to pursue the GOP endorsement at the state convention in early June, or if he is going to just go take his money and his name recognition and go right to the August 14th primary. And all, and he could, because he does have, obviously it's a name recognition, and he does have, apparently right now, $1 million to go work with. A lot of that, though, came from a small number of people. 206 of Pawlenty's donors gave the maximum contribution of $4,000. That means that 84% of his fundraising came from just 206 people. Now, Jeff Johnson, who's been the Republican frontrunner until Pawlenty got into the race, announced that he's raised about a tenth of that, $105,000 in the first quarter of the year, putting him at a significant disadvantage should that they end up with a primary with Pawlenty. Now, how, since it is reporting day for dollars, let's look at the Democrats here for a minute. Representative Tim Walz, the DFL candidate for governor, won the February caucus straw poll, has raised $531,000, more than $500,000 in the first quarter, and he has brought in $1.1 million for 2017. State Auditor Rebecca Otto, who came in second in the DFL straw poll, reported raising about $170,000 with $149,000 cash on hand. Representative Aaron Murphy has $121,000 donated in the first quarter and has $72,000 on hand. So the Democratic candidates have cash, but they may not be as flush as cash as Tim Pawlenty may be right now. Now, here's a headline that you probably never thought you'd hear. Judge Neil Gorsuch joins with liberals on ruling. Yeah, that happened today. The Supreme Court today struck down a law that allowed the government to deport some immigrants who commit serious crimes, saying it was unconstitutionally vague. The decision will limit the Trump administration's efforts to deport people convicted of some kinds of crimes. The vote was 5-4, as many Supreme Court votes are, but Justice Neil Gorsuch was joining the court's four more liberal members to form a bare majority, which that's a first. Justice Gorsuch wrote that the law crossed a constitutional line. He said, vague laws invite arbitrary power. Okay. I guess we get snow in April. We get a decision supported by Neil Gorsuch that goes with the liberals on the court. Okay, we're going to take a break here. But when we get back, we're going to talk about a race that we haven't talked much about, and that's the race for Attorney General. Foregone conclusion that Lori Swanson is going to be the person that's on the DFL ticket. Maybe not so. We'll talk about that next year on the Mike McEntee Show.
The fine folks at Common Good Books will help you find the perfect book for you or the book lover in your life. Find a huge selection from a locally owned and independent bookseller in the Twin Cities. They are always bringing in top authors from around the globe for special in-store events. Open Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. and Sundays, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Find Common Good Books at 38 South Snelling Avenue in St. Paul or shop online at commongoodbooks.com.
Guess who called me the other day? You did. Hi, Mark Sommerfeld of Computer Revolution in Roseville. I want to thank AM950 listeners who called to thank us for supporting the station. So here's an offer exclusive to 950 listeners. Bring your broken computer or cell phone to our Roseville store, say I'm an AM950 listener, and you'll receive $20 off any repair. Computer Revolution with Cell Phone Repair, located in Roseville at Highway 36 and Fairview Avenue, or call 651-633-6600. And thanks.
6 years ago, Dr. Emily Stein was confronted with a life-changing situation. Her grandmother developed rheumatoid arthritis and was unable to maintain her own dental hygiene. Unfortunately, her assisted living facility didn't have the resources to help her maintain her dental health either. Once her dental health deteriorated, her overall health deteriorated too. It wasn't long until she had multiple tooth extractions and a severe stroke. That's when Emily put her Stanford background in microbiology and immunology to work. She created an oral care lozenge, or Smart Mint, that manages oral bacteria to promote strong teeth, healthy gums, and fresh breath. Daily Dental Care is a life sciences company dedicated to addressing public health by targeting the root cause of dental disease. Because let's face it, we all could use a little extra help supplementing our daily dental care routine. Visit dailydentalcareswithans.com or go to Amazon to purchase our lozenges and use promo code DDC95002 for a 25% discount on your first purchase.
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Daily Dental Care lozenges are not intended to replace daily dental hygiene practices.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. Attorney General Lori Swanson was a long-rumored candidate for governor. So many people thought she was going to run, that a bunch of DFLers announced that they were going to run for attorney general with the caveat that they were running only if Lori Swanson wasn't. Now, when Swanson indicated she was going to run for re-election and not for governor, most of those other candidates dropped out. But Matt Pelican has remained in the race. He joins us now to talk about his run for the DFL endorsement. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike. Glad to be here.
So I got to ask you, why keep running if Swanson is running? Assumption is that she gets that she's going to get this endorsement in a cakewalk.
Yeah, well, I've been in the race from the beginning, regardless of Lori's intentions, for the same reason, because I think we need a strong and progressive attorney general. As we see around the country right now, AGs are playing a leading role in opposing the Trump administration, but also there's so much important work in getting an economy that's working for people and continuing the fight for civil rights and equal rights. This is an office that we really need to see use the full ability and full powers under the law. I don't think we have to look further than a sterling legacy of strong progressive attorneys general past like Warren Spanis and Skip Humphrey. And I think that we really need to see this office rise to the occasion. And that's why I've been in the race, and it's why I'm staying in the race.
I noticed you didn't mention Mike Hatch when you were talking about sterling reputations. Lori Swanson, a protege of Hatch, do you have any problems with how she's been doing the job?
You know, I want a positive and forward-looking campaign, but I do think that there are a number of areas where we have real disagreements. It touches on everything from gun control to prescription drug pricing and antitrust enforcement, LGBT rights, immigrant rights, workers' rights. This is an office that needs to do everything it can, and right now I don't think it is.
Okay. Well, let's touch on some of those issues, because we were just talking before we got on the air here, and you mentioned gun control. You mentioned that Lori Swanson, you say, has an NRA rating of A+. I found that kind of interesting. I hadn't heard that issue brought up before. Tell us how you and her differ.
Well, first, it's one reason that these races matter, and I want to talk about how this office can be as strong as possible. A lot of folks aren't aware that Lori Swanson is one of the NRA's strongest allies in the country. She did that in 2008 by joining forces with Ted Cruz in a landmark decision called DC v. Heller that was authored by Antonin Scalia that was a radical departure from Second Amendment jurisprudence and drastically expanded access to firearms under the guise of the Second Amendment. The work of the AG's office extends all the way to today, where there's a dangerous piece of legislation working its way through the U.S. Congress right now called the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act. Now, this bill would take away the ability of states like Minnesota to set our own permit laws. 17 AGs have banded together to speak out against this legislation, and Minnesota has been conspicuously silent. I think it is long past time for us to stem the tide of gun violence in our communities, and I think it begins with popular common sense things like universal background checks and keeping guns out of the hands of people who have no business getting them in the first place. We need an attorney general who's going to be a partner on this, and as attorney general, I won't stand with the NRA. I'll stand up to the NRA.
Now, Lori Swanson has been challenging the Trump administration on a lot of different issues. She's joined suits from several other states. Do you support what she's been doing so far, or do you think she should have been going further?
Well, it's kind of the outsource in chief, where not a single one of the lawsuits that you've heard about in the newspaper has been initiated in Minnesota or is run out of Minnesota. We are depending completely on the work of other attorneys general, and I think that our office needs to step up and really be on the front lines. So, yes, it's great to be it's great to sign your name on the line of the work of other attorneys general, but there is an important work here. Net neutrality is an important issue. 18 AGs got together to oppose the FCC's rollback of net neutrality protections. I called on Lori to join that case, and finally Minnesota was the 19th state to step up. But, you know, these are issues that I think we need to be really pushing the boundaries and not just following the work of other states. DACA is another one where a number of lawsuits came forward on that, and our attorney general was busy studying the law and facts. I don't think there's a lot of facts to study on DACA. It's a values question of protecting dreamers and making sure that we're protecting all immigrants who want to make America and Minnesota home. So, you know, it's great to join these lawsuits, but there's a real lack of leadership on critical issues here.
Now, at this point in the race, we still don't have an endorsement. That happens in June when the convention, the DFL convention, gets together. And that's reliant on a known number of people now who are going to be delegates to, or at least will be delegates to that convention. Have you been talking to those delegates, or have you are you focusing more on a campaign that's going to take place after that, challenging maybe in a primary?
I'm abiding by the DFL endorsement. I'm under no illusion that Lori will do the same. But I'm a creature of local activism here. I went to my first precinct caucus when I was 13 years old. I was precinct chair in Northfield, my hometown, before I could vote. I believe in the party process. I believe in the caucus process. It has a lot of barriers and its own issues, but fundamentally, it's a great system of government where we can show up in our neighborhoods, in our communities, and really engage with voters, and voters can engage with politicians. So I'm absolutely participating in the process. I've been to over 50 conventions and local meetings. On Saturday, I started the day in Burnsville at the CD2 endorsing convention, mm-hmm. and then drove up through the snow to Maple Grove to stop by the CD3 convention, and then made it all the way up to Duluth for the CD8 convention. So it's definitely a lot of time, but again, it's a great process of just going city to city and phone call to phone call, talking to delegates. And I'll have to tell you, there's been a really strong response so far.
Oh, you were that guy that made all three. that was a mess on Saturday. I was over at the CD2 convention, and I barely made it back home to Eagan. So congratulations for you to making it all the way up to Duluth. When you're talking to the delegates, when you have this conversation, I mean, a lot of folks aren't focused on this race. It's not the top of their mind. They're thinking of the congressional race. They're thinking of the governor's race. How do you bring them back to talking about this race and, you know, bringing home the point that it's a very important one that you should be the candidate for?
Yeah, well, first of all, I understand that, right? This is probably the biggest year in Minnesota politics that we will ever see. We have both U.S. Senate seats up, which only ever happens through a series of, you know, strange events. We have an open governor's race. We have to take back the state house. We have four targeted U.S. congressional races. So first, I have a lot of understanding that there is, you know, a lot going on this year. But this is an important office, and those conversations begin by talking about how this office is really out of step with a lot of the progressive activists around the state on issues like gun control, on antitrust enforcement, which is another one of my top issues that I think is an essential tool in shifting the balance of power in our economy that simply just isn't a priority right now at the state level in Minnesota. And so I totally understand that, but you just have to go right to the issues and have an issue policy-focused campaign. The other thing I'd add is that this is one reason I've been in the race from the beginning, regardless of Attorney General Swanson's intentions, because I know that there's not that much air left in the room for some of these other races. And when the whole focus is on who's in, who's out, this game of musical chairs in St. Paul, it's not on how this office can be as strong and progressive as possible. And so for me, it was important from the beginning to just say, this is what I want to do in the office. I don't want some of these horse race distractions, because there isn't that much bandwidth to focus on this race. And so, you know, it's given me a leg up in the sense of spending over a year just having the time to really talk about and clarify how I want to take this office in a new direction.
Now, Attorney General is probably not the most glamorous job in state government. It's certainly not the one that gets the most attention, except when there's a big lawsuit, of course. What made you choose that you wanted to run for this? And is this your first race that you've ever run?
I've been involved in Minnesota law and politics for over 20 years, but this is my first time as a candidate. Now, I think Attorney General, frankly, is probably the best job in state government. I mean, I g- God bless Governor Dayton and, you know, what he's doing right now and some of the stuff you talked about on your program of grappling with the Republicans in the legislature. But the Attorney General has incredible autonomy to set priorities and choose which remedies and which cases to pursue. And so I think it's a really wonderful job that can really make a difference in people's lives, which I think is the organizing principle for all of politics. I'll say, for me, the road to running and the road to today started in the first days after the Trump election and wondering what that meant for me personally and progressive politics generally. And I quickly realized that as depressing and dispiriting as Trump's election felt, the only way forward was for people to get more involved, not less. And that's been so encouraging and so wonderful to see around Minnesota as I've traveled on this campaign, because everywhere I go, there are countless first-time delegates stepping up. One question I always ask is, how many people are more involved now than a year and a half ago? And hand after hand goes up. I'll tell you, in a lot of places I've been, especially in greater Minnesota, more than half the delegates at these organizing unit local conventions are first-time delegates, first-time people in the process. And so I'm just like them. I've been involved, but I'm finding a new way to contribute and step up, because it's only together and only finding each of us to lean in our own capacity that we are going to resist and we're going to turn the tide in this country back towards making a difference in economic opportunity and civil rights for people.
Now, a lot of the terms that you're using there, somebody might say, well, you're going to be an activist. You're going to pursue an agenda. Do you think that's the job of the Attorney General?
The Attorney General is empowered to represent all Minnesotans. And I think that comes with a special responsibility to represent people who don't already have great legal representation. So absolutely, I will look at ways to use every single tool available to make a difference in people's lives, to shift the balance of power in our economy, and at the same time, continuing essential work on civil rights and equal rights. For me, it's an all-of-the-above moment in our country's history, and I think the Attorney General has a lot of existing powers under current Minnesota law to push the boundaries there. To mention it again is antitrust. This is an area that you don't have to pass a new law. You don't have to change a lot. It's a tool in the toolbox, if you want to use it, to really hold powerful interests accountable and get more power into the hands of working people in the middle class. And it touches across industries. It touches across regions in Minnesota. And it's something the Attorney General should be doing right now, that the Attorney General can do right now. And so whether it's, you want to say, activist or aggressive, absolutely, the Attorney General has a responsibility to step up and use every tool available.
Now, you mentioned civil rights, and earlier you mentioned that one of the differences between you and Lori Swanson's was when it came to LGBT rights. Tell me what that difference is.
I'm a proud gay Minnesotan, and that has informed my view of the fight for equal rights in the society. I say, don't vote for me because I'm gay, but vote for me in part because of what that has taught me in using politics to lift up voices and empower communities who need a higher platform and need equality in our society. I was a clerk on the Minnesota Supreme Court when the hateful marriage amendment was on the ballot in 2012, and as well as the voter ID ballot. And it was an all-out effort of Minnesota progressives and Democrats to defeat that measure. Our Attorney General was silent on marriage equality for up to 2 years until after it was already the law in Minnesota. We need an Attorney General who is going to be a vocal advocate and a strong ally, not only of the LGBT community, but all communities and peoples in Minnesota who are looking for equal rights before the law.
Now, a lot of candidates like to do a direct contrast with their opponent. We've been talking about some of those right here. The best way to usually contrast that is when you have a debate. Are you and Lori Swanson going to have any kind of debate before the convention in June?
Not if she has anything to say about it is my impression, but I would be happy to have that conversation, whether it's a forum or a debate. I'll tell you, there has not been a single joint appearance agreed to, but I would, I'd just say anywhere, anytime.
I've noticed that on social media that you mentioned that Swanson seems to avoid appearing with you at the same events that you may be scheduled together and then she cancels out.
That's been my perception so far. I mean, we haven't shared in an event or a stage. you know, she has to run her own schedule and her own campaign. But again, I agree. I think Minnesotans would benefit from, you know, a compare and contrast, and that's what elections are all about. So I welcome the opportunity to continue that dialogue either directly in person or, you know, through the course of a campaign at our own events and pitches.
All right. And you've got your website out there. I think it is mattpelikan.com, P-E-L-I-K-A-N.com for folks. And it's two T's on Matt's, I think, so people can go there. They can sign up. Do you have a lot of your positions that we've been talking about there, or just pretty much a way to get in touch with you?
Yeah, the website right now is a little bit of kind of a launch page. It has my biography. We are working on a full rollout here in the next couple weeks. I'd also encourage folks to check me out on Facebook, Matt Pelikan, or Matt Pelikan for Attorney General, and Twitter. And my email is just Matt, M-A-T-T, at mattpelikan.com. And I welcome any questions or feedback. I'm happy to engage with anyone who has ideas on the race or wants to share their thoughts on the Attorney General's office.
Okay. Well, Matt, I appreciate you taking the time because this, again, it's a race that most people don't, it isn't top of mind when we're going into not only the general election, but just, you know, the various votes that we have here ahead of time in the primary and also at the various conventions that are going to be happening. So I'm glad to give you a platform here to talk to our listeners, many of them who are probably delegates at the DFL. So thank you again for your time today.
Definitely. I appreciate it very much, and thanks for the opportunity.
All right. We're going to take a break here, but when we get back, we're going to talk about a couple of oops and how they're being dealt with. That's next here on the Mike McEntee Show.
Freeway, freeway, take me home. Back to where.
The number one source of the Twin Cities gay scene is all digital. Follow Twin Cities Gay Scene on Facebook and Twitter. Sign up for the Scene Shot email blast for weekly updates and chances to win great prizes. No app is needed to view the bi-weekly web editions of Scene. It's GLBTQ media for the mobile generation. Find it all at TwinCitiesGayScene.com. That's TwinCitiesGayScene.com.
Burger Mo's is the perfect neighborhood gathering spot before and after Excel Center events or anytime. Mo is serious about burgers, offering 20 fresh, never frozen varieties. Burger Mo's also offers delicious appetizers, soups, salads, as well as unburgers, dogs, paninis, shakes, and desserts. Not to mention more than 60 beers on tap and happy hours twice daily. Burger Mo's is located at 242 West 7th Street in St. Paul with plenty of free parking and online at burgermo's.com.
This is Bill McLeslie, owner of IP House in Minneapolis. I started IP House with the mission of making technology simple again. Over the last 10 years, my team has helped hundreds of businesses with their technology. We provide on-site support and technical strategy for businesses just like yours. If your technology has you feeling on edge, call us. We take the mystery out of technology and make things simple again. IP House, supporting businesses just like yours every day. 612-337-6337.
No matter what your taste, you'll find the music you're looking for at the Electric Fetus. Pick from rock, pop, international, roots music, and so much more on CD and vinyl. Or create your own compilation of favorites with the exclusive Mix and Burn CD station, only available at the Electric Fetus. Dust off your vinyl or just make some space by turning your unwanted music into cash. The used selection changes daily, so check out the new arrivals often. 2000 4th Avenue South in Minneapolis and online at efetus.com.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. Norman Goldman coming up here at the top of the hour afternoon, so hang around for that. And last segment, we were talking to Matt Pelikan, Attorney General candidate, going for the DFL endorsement. I just want to mention that we will be reaching out to Lori Swanson, our current Attorney General, who is also seeking the DFL endorsement again, and see if she likes to drop by and talk about her race as well, because we do like to make sure that we are playing fair here. A couple of oops that we need to talk about. The IRS had an unexpected message for people who waited until today to make their annual tax day payments through the agency's website. It said, come back on December 31st, 9999. not even 1999, like Prince. No, 9999. It was an outage on the agency's website, which began on this morning and was unresolved by midday. It crippled a crucial part of the tax collection agency's website that allows taxpayers to make their payments directly through their bank accounts instead of paying fees that come by using debit or credit cards. Those who wanted to make a payment were greeted with the message, "This service is currently unavailable." It said the website was undergoing a planned outage. Okay. Yeah. It was beginning on tax day and would last until December 31st, 9999. Okay. The error message said taxpayers were still due despite the glitch. Bruce Friedland, the IRS spokesperson who unfortunately was tasked with trying to respond to this, said taxpayers should continue filing their tax returns as they normally would. It's unclear what caused the outage. Here's the thing. Why did this happen? The outage came as Republican lawmakers have been mulling legislation to restructure the IRS after years of depleted budgets for the agency. See, that's the problem. If you don't fund things, you can't complain when they don't work. And, you know, basically, again, Republicans have been trying to take government and make it as small as they can and drown it in the bathtub because they don't want the IRS to collect your money. That's just going to fund all those liberal projects that they don't want to do. So there's your oops. It's not really that the website didn't work. It's the fact that we haven't been funding it. And speaking of funding, Sun Country. You've been hearing their name coming up in the news here the last 48 hours because they stranded a bunch of passengers down in Mexico during the snowstorm. Well, today they said, yeah, we'll pony up and pay the additional travel costs faced by about 250 people who are left stranded in Mexico. In addition to those refunds, Sun Country is going to cover additional reasonable transportation costs. It doesn't exactly say what that is, but including the difference they paid to, rebook on another carrier, as well as taxis, shuttles, and other expenses for getting to and from the airport. This is according to Jude Bricker, the airline's chief executive, another job that I wouldn't like to have today. The airline has received numerous complaints from passengers and lots of lousy media coverage as well for its handling of the cancellations. Which was exacerbated by the staffing problems caused by the snowstorm and a seasonal switch in Sun Country's routes, meaning they didn't have a plane down there. So the good news is people will get refunded. Bad news is they still have to get home on their own. They're not sending their own damn flight down there to get them. Well, I guess you're going to be stranded someplace. Mazatlan, Mexico is a lot better than being stranded maybe in Duluth or Ely. Hey, I'm back here tomorrow. Nothing against Duluth or Ely. It's just nicer in Mexico. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.